I will have that question.
Have we got the next stuff up? I'll let you. Sorry, I need to do this here, don't I? Okay, this guy is Athanasius. We're really moving about in history now. His name's Athanasius. It means the immortal. He was a real character, 4th century guy. He was a slightly naughtier character than John Calvin. Calvin was a lover of Jesus Christ. Athanasius was also a lover of Jesus Christ, but yeah, a slightly naughty-minded one. He had a crazy life in the 4th century. He was born just before the year 300. That's probably absolutely nothing like what he actually looked like. Apparently he was very dark in complexion, and he was very, very small. Anyway, he was born just before the year 300 in the north of Egypt. He was an Egyptian around Alexandria. Then, when he was about 20 years old, the troubles that would define his life started. There was an elder in the church in Alexandria. His name was Arius. We do have a picture of him. The fact he had no reflection should have given it away. Now, does anyone know what Arius began teaching? Anyone know what this guy taught? Arius taught that the Son was a created being. That God had created the Son. Basically because God, for some reason, wanted there to be a creation, but then thought, but I don't want to touch mud and stuff. I don't want to touch creation. So I'll make some little grunt who can do it for me. So I'll make this kind of godlet, and he can do the dirty work and make creation. So God created the Son to create the universe. He was a brilliant propagandist, Arius. Set up a magazine called The Watchtower, and his legacy lives on. What he did do is he got his theology sung. Round, so he got choirs to sing his theology in the streets of Alexandria. So they'd wander around singing, "There once was a time when the sun was not, do-da, do-da," that kind of stuff. And which got really popular, actually. So choirs singing all around the Mediterranean became a really popular thing. And what people who disagreed with Arius started realizing is the choirs are working. Because when you sing the theology like that, the heresy goes in nicely. Singing, you can sing anything you want in, whether it be truth or error. And so what people who disagreed with Arius thought is, let's have choirs who are singing the opposite. Do you know what happened? Yeah, there were fights in the streets. And so you have rival choirs in street fights over, is the sun created or not? Anyway, Athanasius was going to spend his life trying to take out this theology, and we'll see why it was just so, so dangerous. Let me tell you a little bit more about Athanasius. Unfortunately for Athanasius, he was not liked by the emperor. The emperor agreed with Arius. By the way, his name was Constantius. He was the son of the famous Constantine the Great, or as our German friends would call him, Constantine the Gross. And this emperor, he tried to get Athanasius a number of times. So, for example, there was one time Athanasius was leading a prayer meeting in a church building in Alexandria. And what happened is 5,000 imperial stormtroopers surrounded the building and then simultaneously rushed the building from multiple entrances, firing arrows in with swords drawn as they came in. Athanasius, to stop the carnage, tried to get people out so that they wouldn't get hurt and stayed himself. But just to give an indication of how much he was loved, remember he was a little guy. One of his friends, who's quite a bit bigger, just tucked him under his cloak and rushed him out. So he was got out because he was dearly beloved. And okay, this will tell you a bit about his character. There was one time the stormtroopers were after him, And he was heading in a little boat up the Nile to get away from them. And this imperial troop ship was obviously going faster than him, pursuing him up the Nile. And so what happened is the troop ship was closing in on his little tug. So Athanasius said, "Turn the boat round." So they turned the boat round, thinking, "What are you doing, Athanasius?" Turned it around, came alongside the imperial ship. And the imperial ship troop captain shouted out, "Have you seen Athanasius?" At which point Athanasius himself said, "Yeah, he's not far off." And the imperial troop ship carried on whilst Athanasius just slunk back into Alexandria. That's sort of guy, go with a twinkle in his eye. He's a fun guy. Anyway, let's try to see what... should we get rid of this? that might be putting you off. Okay, so Arius taught the Son was not truly God. Now, you may go, "Well, I don't agree with that." But here's the interesting thing. Arius got to that conclusion by going through a thought process you go through every day. Ouch. He got there by going through a thought process we go through every day. Basically, he got there by trying to think about God without going through Jesus. Jesus not being the definition, the revelation of God. Now, the way Arius did it was like this. He said, okay, God is the one who causes everything to exist, right? But God is different from everything else in that God is not caused to exist. Make sense? So God is the uncaused, or the unoriginate, in that he has no origin from elsewhere. He is the uncaused cause of everything else. Now, that sounds pretty reasonable, doesn't it? God causes everything else to exist, but he's not himself caused to exist. There you go. That's our basic definition of God. Athanasius saw there is a monumental problem with that definition. Well, there are a few monumental problems with that definition. It meant... Well, let's just see what sort of God you'd be left with if that's God. So he's defined God without the Son in a very reasonable sounding way. But the very shape of Arius' gospel would be entirely different because he understood God differently. So who would Arius pray to, for instance? How would he start any prayer? It would be, "O unoriginate." Oh, that's going to be a great prayer life, isn't there? "O unoriginate, O uncaused." Do you think uncaused is going to listen? Well, who knows? You don't know what sort of God you're dealing with here. You seem to have a God who's, well, not the sort of God you're going to want to pray to. But if you try to think of God without the Son, Athanasius saw, you're going to be left with the unoriginate, the uncaused. And what I want to do is just have a little look at what would such a God look like. So, how do we get to know what this God might be like? So remember what Arius thought. Arius thought God had created the Son, that the Son might go on and create the world. So what was God like before he created the Son? Right? If you want to know what God's really like, what was God like? What was God like all the way back, way when, before he created the Son? Yeah? Does that make sense as a question? What was he like? Well, before he'd caused anything else to exist, this God must be all alone. Right? Absolutely, he hasn't caused anything else to exist. Hasn't caused the Son to exist. Hasn't caused anything else to exist. He is alone for eternity. So he's alone for eternity. So for eternity, he's had nobody and nothing to love. Right? Therefore, love clearly is not how he ticks. He's never loved for eternity. He might love himself. We don't tend to call that loving, do we? Does that make sense? There's nobody, nothing that he could love for eternity. So he's not defined by outgoing love for others. That's just not his nature. So he must be all about himself. He must be essentially all about private self-gratification. That's what he's essentially all about. And you get to see this with single person gods. It must inevitably be self-centered beings because they've been lonely for eternity on their own. That's how they've been for eternity. That's how they clearly are happy to be. And so with such a God, you think, why would you actually want anything else ever to exist? Right? Let's say you've been on your own for eternity. Why do you want something else to exist? You've clearly been happy for a long time without it. And so the existence of a creation just looks rather awkward for such a God. Why would they want to create? Creating looks a deeply unnatural thing to do. And what you get to see is not just Arius, but with other single person gods, if they do create, they always seem to do so out of an essential neediness. They want something. Or a desire to use what they create merely for their own self-gratification. To use what they create. So, one of the earliest examples we have is in the ancient Babylonian creation myth. The god Marduk says he's going to create humanity. Why? To be gracious to them? To be kind to them? Nope. So that they can be his slaves. That's why we exist. To be God's slaves. So this God, single person God that Arius has come up with, wants to think about himself. That's what he's done for eternity. That's clearly what he likes doing. So the existence of creation, the existence of you, is an irritating distraction for him. You are an irritating distraction for the God whose greatest pleasure is looking in a mirror. Do you ever kind of feel that, get that sense? Any remote sense that it's like that when you pray? Why would God ever want to listen to me? It's not his delight to hear the prayers of his children. That it's as if he's up in heaven thinking, what now, earthling? Doing this sort of thing. Why would you? If you ever come close to thinking anything like that, you're thinking of Arius God, the lonely God, the single person God. He's an entirely different character. I just want to press in a little bit more to what this God's like, and it's going to get you thoroughly depressed, and then I'm going to show you how Athanasius overturns it all to produce a glorious gospel. So, if God was not a father, if God is essentially not a father, well, he couldn't give us the right to be his children, could he? There wouldn't be that in any salvation. If he didn't enjoy eternal fellowship with his son, well, does he even know what fellowship looks like? He's been alone for all eternity. Does he know what fellowship is? Does he want fellowship? Probably not. So if, for example, the Son was actually a creature and had not eternally been loved by the Father, or as John puts it, in the bosom of the Father, being loved by him, what sort of relationship, if that was the case, if the Son was just a creature, what sort of relationship with the Father could the Son give us? Let's say the Son was just like an angel, a created angel. What sort of relationship with God could he give us? That'd be a very distant one, wouldn't it? If he were just like an angel, the only kind of relationship with God he could give us is like an angel's relationship to God. So God's the creator, you're his creature, but that's it. No more intimacy than that. If the Son himself had never been close to the Father, if he were a mere creature, he could never bring us close to the Father. So the very nature of our salvation rolls out of which sort of God we've got. If God was a single person, as Arius is suggesting, who at some point had created the Son, if God eternally had had no Son, salvation would look entirely different. That this God, Arius God, would allow you to live under his rule and protection, but at an infinite distance, probably approached through intermediaries. But I mean, possibly he might offer forgiveness, but he simply could not offer closeness. Eternally, he's never had a relationship, never had fellowship. He doesn't know what such a thing is. And since, by definition, he would not be eternally loving, would he deal with the price of sin himself? And so offer forgiveness for free? Pretty unlikely, don't you think? Distant hirelings we'd remain. And with such a God, you would never hear the son's golden words to his father. John 17:23. The son says to his father, "Father, you have loved them even as you have loved me." Whoa. Isn't that amazing words? Because being in Christ, we are loved with the love that the Father loves the Son. But if the Son's not eternally loved by the Father, if he's just a creature, then we can't have that. If we're created to be slaves, we're simply saved to be slaves. So God is a single person, has always been alone. You have a very watered down salvation. And you have to wonder, would he actually even reveal himself? If God's gone for eternity without ever speaking, ever communicating, why would he start speaking, communicating, revealing himself? The habit of keeping himself to himself would clearly run very deep. And so for Arius, there was no true revelation of God. Yeah? Because if the Son was just a created being, you couldn't look at the Son and go, he is the exact representation of his Father's being. Right? He is the bright radiance of his Father's glory. If the Son was a mere creature and not of the very being of the Father, then Jesus was lying when he said, if you've seen me, you've seen the Father. Because he's not like the Father. He's just a creature, maybe representing God. See? Jesus offers no real revelation, no real salvation, if he's just a creature. All the revelations such a Jesus could offer would be a pale imitation of what God's like, possibly. So if Arius is right, God couldn't really reveal himself, and he doesn't have much of a salvation to offer. And then what then would the Christian life look like if Arius was right? Do you see, from that very reasonable starting point, everything's been wasted in Christianity. What does the Christian life look like? Well, quite apart from questions like, would this God be gracious? What do we know about this single person God? What's the thing we definitely know about him? Eternally. Eternally he's been self-obsessed, right? Thinking only about himself. Right? So what is it then to be godly? To be like God? Be self-obsessed. Think about yourself the whole time. That's being like God. Now you're really like this God. And in fact, what Arius had done is basically he had pinched a definition of God from the Greek philosopher Aristotle. Aristotle had said, God is the uncaused cause. That's what Arius is picking up. But what Aristotle said, is he said that God is just so turned on by himself, just so in love with himself, that he finds his own majesty so all-consuming that he simply wouldn't want to think about anything else. Right? All he wants to think about is you. Is himself. You are beneath his consideration. So all he wants to do is think, me. He simply does not want to think about you. And so to be godlike would to mean being introspective. Can you see one other problem with this? So you've got a deeply unattractive, self-obsessed God. Can you see a problem by saying, for a Christian, by saying God is defined by being the uncaused cause? Can you see another problem with this? See a problem with it? If that is the definition of God. He's never caused to exist by anything else, but He causes everything else to exist. That's who he is. See a problem with that? Yeah.
How can you be a man?
How can you be a man? Go on, what do you mean, how could you be a man? There's a lot about the Son, and eternally. This was why Arius first said the Son cannot be God. Because he's saying, well, if God is uncaused, if God receives his origin from no one else, well, the Son, by being a Son, cannot be God. Because he receives his being from the Father, right? So if God is the uncaused cause, the Son ain't God. Does that make sense? Yeah? If God receives his origin from nowhere else, but the Son receives his being from the Father, clearly the Son is not God. Yeah, so we've got a problem. So the Son disappears in a puff of philosophy. What else? What might be a problem with saying God is the one who receives his origin from nowhere else, but is the core, is his identity is to be the cause of everything else?
Sin.
Go on. Yeah, it's probably the cause of sin, yeah. It is a tricky one. Go on, how's he dependent on us? Exactly. Exactly. If his identity is to be the one who causes everything to be, then he needs us to be who he is. Right? But put it this way, if God's identity is, he is the creator, that's the most fundamental thing to be said about him, he's the creator, that's who he is, then he needs his creation to be who he is. Right? Oops. And so for all his cosmic power, he's pitiful. He needs us to be who he is. Right? Exactly, you've got a massive problem there. But that was Arius. Trying to think about God without going through the Son, he left himself with a Christianity that just didn't look Christian. He had a God so cold and distant that, of course, you'd find yourself starting to be more interested in yourself than in him. Ignoring the way, the truth, and the life, he was defining God without the Son, and therefore his understanding of God was affected. You have a God who's not eternally loving. His understanding was salvation was affected. Here's a God who can have no fellowship with us, no Son to bring us close, no Spirit through whom we might know him. So Arius was left with a very thin gruel. He didn't mean it, but by defining God without Jesus, he was left with a life of self-dependent effort under the all-seeing eye of a distant and loveless God. See it? As soon as you try to think of God without having your understanding of God defined by the Son, the way, the truth, and the life, every part of Christianity is ruined. And that's what Arius did. Depressed now? Okay. Enter Athanasius to drive Arius away. Now, Athanasius, the immortal. Athanasius simply boggled at Arius' presumption. Athanasius was thinking, how can you possibly know what God is like other than as he has revealed himself? You cannot simply say, this is what God is like, I can define him simply by my own brain power. God has to reveal himself. And how has God revealed himself? He says, it is more pious and more accurate to signify, to understand God from the Son and call him Father than to name him from his works only and call him unoriginate. Let me read that again because it's quite complex. The right way to go in thinking about God, the more pious, the accurate way to understand God is you go to the Son. Now, if the Son is the revelation of God, what sort of God is he revealing? The Son. He's revealing a God who is Father. right? That's a very different sort of God. So that's how you go. You say, the revelation of God is the Son of God. And that means the God he reveals is a Father. That's the way to go. You don't try to name him from his works only, e.g. he's created things. That's who he is. And then call him unoriginal. So the right way to think about God is you start with Jesus Christ, the Son of God. You don't start with some abstract definition you've made up, like uncaused or unoriginate. And in fact, he's saying you don't even set out in your understanding of God by thinking of God primarily as creator. That's naming him from his works only. Because if you say God is the creator, that's the most fundamental thing to be said about him, that's his identity, then he needs his creation to be who he is. Athanasius is wanting to say there is something more fundamental in God, something deeper to be said. There was a time when he wasn't yet a creator. What was he like then, before he created? So he's saying our definition of God must be built on the Son who reveals God. And when we do that, starting with the Son, we find, as it says in the creed that Athanasius wanted to uphold, we believe in one God, the Father. And we find that that is the most fundamental thing to be said about God. More fundamental than the fact that he's the creator. More fundamental than the fact that he rules the world. We believe in one God, the Father. So Jesus says to himself, I am the way to think about God. I am the truth. I am the life. No one comes to the Father but through me. You won't know God's deepest identity unless you go through Jesus the Son. And being a son means he has a father. And that is who God has revealed himself to be. Not first and foremost creator, though that's true. He is the creator. Not first and foremost ruler, though that's true. He is the ruler. But before he ever created, before he ruled over his creation, he was a father. And that different starting point and basic understanding of God was going to mean that the gospel Athanasius preached would simply taste and feel very different to that of Arius. How would Athanasius pray? What sort of God is he addressing? O unoriginate? No, our Father. Immediately, just from that, you sense the difference of the gospel that Athanasius has got. Now, I just need to say at this point, I know not everyone warms to the idea of God as a father. Some people's experience of their own human father as being cold, abusive, indifferent makes them squirm at the language of God as a father. And if that applies to anyone here, I'm so sorry for you. So sorry if you've had that experience. And those of us who are fathers ourselves know we are very far from perfect. But it is quite simply a misstep to apply the failings of our human fathers to the Father. Because the Father is not called Father because he's a pumped up version of our dads. It is that human fathers are supposed to reflect the Father and who he is. They are supposed to do that. They're supposed to reflect how the Father is with his Son. But realistically, in a fallen world, where some do that quite well, others do a better job of reflecting the devil than this God. So, if God is Father, well, what does it mean to say God is a Father? What does that mean? Well, key thing is, I think a lot of the time people think that it's just one of those names you can trot past, that we might as well call him Bob. It's just, it happens to be a name, but it doesn't actually mean anything. So, for example, because names don't mean much in our culture, do they? So, my dog's called Max. describe Max to me. You know absolutely nothing about Max. He might want to tear your throat out or wag at you. You don't know what sort of dog he is because his name conveys nothing about him. But Father, his name does actually mean something. He's called Father because he is a father. And that's quite a leap, sorry, from talking about Max, my dog, to talking about the Father. But calling this God Father just changes everything. A father is a person who gives out life, who begets children. Right? That's what it is to be a father. If you don't have a child, you're not a father. And that insight is like a stick of dynamite in all your thoughts about God. And that's what Athanasius would pull out. It's really, I just want to unpack this insight, which is rolling out in everything he would say. That if, before all things, God was eternally a father, then this God is an inherently outgoing, life-giving, loving God. So he didn't give life for the first time when he created. From eternity, this God has been life-giving, giving life to his Son, pouring out love on his Son. Now this gets unpacked for us in 1 John 4. Come with me to 1 John 4. And it's not like Paul for being weird, but it's outrageous stuff. 1 John 4, verse 7. Dear friends, let us love one another, for love comes from God. Now get this. Everyone who loves has been born of God and knows God. Whoever does not love does not know God, because God is love. Wow! If they do not love, they simply cannot know God. Okay, let's try to think what's going on here. Do you know, of course at Eden you will know, do you know a mature Christian who is so Christ-like, so overflowing in generosity, of warmness of spirit, of kindness, of love. They just radiate joy and love in Christ. You know this sort of person? I can think of a few people like that. I think they are being little pictures of what John is trying to describe here. That God is love in such a profound and potent way, you simply cannot know him without yourself becoming loving. Because you know what it is with those people? With these very Christ-like, mature saints. And when you're with them, it's much harder to be nasty about other people, isn't it? Right? When you're with them, it's like they're so loving, you actually, even if only for a moment while you're in their presence, you are more loving and kind, right? Just so it is with this God, knowing this God, being with this God, he's so loving, he makes us loving. Now this is all about what it means for God to be Father, because when John writes, God is love, he's clearly referring to the Father, because the very next words, verse 9, say, God is love. This is how God showed his love among us, that he sent his one and only Son. Right? So the God who is love is the Father who sends his Son. To be the Father means to love. To give out life, to beget the Son, before anything else, for all eternity, this God was loving, giving life to, delighting in his Son. And so seeing this, Athanasius liked to compare God to a fountain. He's actually picking up a scriptural image. It comes up a few times. For example, Jeremiah 2:13, the Lord compares himself to a fountain of living water. Yeah. Now, what Athanasius does with that, he says, okay, a fountain, to be a fountain, must pour forth water, right? If a fountain is not spewing out water, it's not a fountain, right? So the Father, to be Father, must be giving out love and life to his Son, right? But if there's a time when he's not giving out life and love to his Son, well, he's not a Father then, is he? He's not begetting a child, a son. He's not a father. And so, therefore, that means to be Father, so just as for a fountain to be a fountain, must pour forth water, for the Father to be Father, he must pour forth life in his Son. That is who he is. That's his most fundamental identity, which means love is not something that this God has, merely one of his many moods. Rather, this God is love eternally. If he did not love, he would not be Father. Make sense? So, let's think about it this way. What was God like before he created? Before the creation of the world? What was God like before the creation of the world? Now, there are some theologians who wanted to say, what was God doing before the creation of the world? He was inventing hell for those cheeky enough to ask such questions. Actually, it's not a hard question to answer at all, because Jesus tells you explicitly in John 17:24. Jesus says, Father, you loved me before the foundation of the world. And so what Athanasius is doing, he's pressing in to see, yes, before anything else, that's who God is. God is a Father loving his Son as he poured out his Spirit upon him. And what I want to do is, just with that in place, what I want to do is do something I won't be able to get to do this afternoon, so I'll do it now. I just want to show you how Christians agree on these absolute essentials of the faith across centuries. So I'm going to step away from Athanasius for a moment and show you something that John Calvin said. John Calvin is over 1,000 years later in complete agreement with Athanasius. Now, Calvin, he's seeing, I'm going to read you a bit more from the Institutes. Calvin's seeing that since God is, before all things, a Father, he's not primarily creator or ruler. Therefore, it's not that this God does being Father as a day job. Yeah? And then he kicks back in the evenings as just plain old God. Now, he is Father all the way down. There's never a time when he starts becoming a father. And so there's never a time when there's something more basic in this God. No, all that he does as Father, because that's who he is. He creates as a father and he rules as a father. And that means, and this is Calvin's brilliant insight, that the way that this God rules over creation is most unlike the way any other God would rule over creation. Okay, get this. Calvin said, we ought, in the very order of things, he's talking about creation, diligently to contemplate God's fatherly love. So when we think about creation, we should think about God's fatherly love. For as a foreseeing and diligent father of the family, he shows his wonderful goodness towards us. Think of this, just when you're looking at God's providential care of all creation. This is what Calvin wants you to see. It's a fatherly care. To conclude once for all, this is his conclusion as he's looking at the whole understanding of God's providence. He says, to conclude once for all, whenever we call God the creator of heaven and earth, let us at the same time bear in mind we are indeed his children, whom he has received into his faithful protection to nourish and educate, and so invited by the great sweetness of his beneficence, his kindness, his goodness, let us study to love and serve him with all our heart. You see, what he's saying It's a very profound observation. It's only when we see that God rules his creation as who he is, as a kind and loving father, only when you get that will you be moved to delight in his sovereign providence. Right? Now, with another God, you could acknowledge the rule of some heavenly policeman and say, yes, he's God, he has a right to rule over it. But I'm not thrilled about it, it's just, c'est la vie. He's the boss, so, yeah, he rules, but so what? Very different. I couldn't take delight in the regime of another God, though it could be right and proper, whereas I can take delight in the tender care and sovereignty of my Father. That's something Calvin said. Now, here's a theologian we're not going to look at today, but I can hardly get through a day without mentioning this guy. Do you know who this is? It's the great reformer Martin Luther. Clearly, this was painted a few years after the Reformation. He was a lot slimmer when he was a monk. And when he was a monk, I wish I'd got a picture of him as a monk. It's in the book, actually. You can see a little picture of him, very scrawny as a monk. And as a monk, his mind was filled with the knowledge that God is righteous and he hates sin. But he didn't know what that meant. He couldn't see that as a good thing. He couldn't peer any further into who God is. And the result was, he said, I did not love, yes, I hated the righteous God who punishes sinners. And secretly, if not blasphemously, certainly murmuring greatly, I was angry with God. Because all he knew about God is righteous and wants to punish sinners. I just don't love a God like that. That seems to be a God who's against me, and maybe he has a right to be against me, but I'm just not one to him. Not knowing God as who he essentially is, as a kind and willing father, God who brings us close, Luther found he could not love God. And that was one of his real struggles as a monk. Now, we all love something or someone. We are created as lovers. You always love someone or something, whatever that may be. So Luther had to love someone or something, but he couldn't love God. Guess where he transferred his affections? If he simply could not love God, who or what would he love? Mary. Right? Mary and the saints. Because God was righteous and distant. I had a right to condemn him, but it just turned his heart against God. But Mary seemed to be kind, gracious. And so he loved Mary. Isn't that interesting? Because she was gracious, and upon grace alone can the heart of man rest. You'll love someone like that. Well, this changed for Luther when he began to see how God is fatherly. And looking back later in his life, he reflected that as a monk, he'd not actually been worshipping the right God. For, he said, it is not enough to know God as the creator and judge. Only when God is known as a loving father is he known aright. That's the first article of the creed. Here's a bit from Luther. He said, for although the whole world has most carefully sought to understand the nature, mind, and activity of God, it has had no success in this whatsoever. But God has revealed and disclosed the deepest profundity of his fatherly heart, his sheer inexpressible love. See, through sending his son to win us back, God has revealed himself to be inexpressibly loving and supremely fatherly in bringing us to himself as his children. And what Luther found is, not only does that give great assurance and joy, it actually wins our hearts to him. And we begin to go, here's a God I actually want and love. For, he said, we may look into God's fatherly heart and sense how boundlessly he loves us. That would warm our hearts, setting them aglow. Luther's saying, here in this God is a God we can truly, without faking it, actually love. There's something from Calvin, there's something from Luther. This afternoon, I'm going to introduce you to this cool guy, Richard Sibbs. I'll tell you more about him this afternoon. Now this quote of his, this could almost be Athanasius. He says, if God did not have a communicative, spreading goodness, he's trying to say, what, with this sort of God, why would this God create? He's saying, if God did not have a communicative, he wants to communicate, to spread his goodness, well, he would never have created the world. Wow. He would never have bothered. But the Father, Son, and Holy Ghost were happy in themselves. They enjoyed one another before the world was. Apart from the fact that God delights to communicate, spread his goodness, there had never been a creation or redemption. E.g., you have this God. This God did not need to create the world, unlike Arius God. He needed nothing. Father, Son, and Holy Ghost were happy in themselves, enjoyed one another before the world was. No need in us. Didn't need to create at all. But the Father so enjoyed his fellowship with his Son that he wanted to spread the goodness of it, that there might be many sons and daughters adopted in the Son, that his Son might be the firstborn among many brothers. And so creation itself was the outburst of this God's love. Now, just when you look around at the creation, you think, why is it there? Why is all that there? Because God so loved. Isn't that beautiful? See the point? This God, a Father who's eternally loved his Son, does not begrudge having someone beside him. He loves it. Against Arius God, who is lonely and used to being lonely, an eternally socially awkward single guy. This God likes relationship. He has always enjoyed showering his love on his Son and rejoices to shower it on the children that he will love through the Son. The fountain of love brims over. The Father so delighted in his Son that his love for him overflowed, that there might be many sons. And that's why the triune God creates, for that beautiful purpose. And so grace, you see, with this God is not merely his reaction, is not merely his kindness to those who have sinned. The very creation is a work of grace. A work of kindness flowing from God's love. Love is not a reaction with this God. They say in heaven, love comes first. He gives life and being as a free gift because his very life, being, and goodness is yeasty. And to spread out, to share, that there might be more that is truly good. Do you see the contrast between Arius God and Athanasius God? Arius, single person God, is empty, hungry, grasping, envious. Athanasius God, the Father who loves his Son, is superabundant, radiant, generous, life-giving. That's who he is. In fact, just flip with me to 1 Peter. Just see a contrast here. 1 Peter 5. Just compare, when we think of a single person God, an absolutely singular, supreme, powerful, spiritual being, what sort of being ultimately must we be thinking of? There is such a being in reality. The devil. Absolutely selfish, singular, powerful, not loving. Now read 1 Peter 5 from verse 6. Humble yourself, therefore, under God's mighty hand, that he might lift you up in due time. Cast all your anxiety upon him, because he cares for you. That's this God. Cast all your anxiety upon him, because he cares for you. Verse 8. Be alert and of sober mind, because your enemy, the devil, prowls around like a roaring lion, looking for someone to devour. See the difference? The absolutely singular God, the devil, is seeking to devour, to take from you. Versus, cast all your anxiety upon him because he cares for you. He's kind and loving. You see, what Athanasius is getting at is you look to Jesus every day, start each day, you look to Jesus. And you see that God is different. You see, he's overwhelmingly different to all other gods. The God revealed in Jesus is not needy, not solitary, not selfish. He's bountiful, self-giving at the heart of who he is. And so here, what Athanasius revealed, pulled straight out of scripture so purely, is here is a God we can really want. He's so good. Here is a God who's not simply sovereign, a God whose sovereignty we can wholeheartedly rejoice in and go, yeah, I want that God to be sovereign. Because he wields his sovereignty in the name of his kindness and love and goodness. There's one other thing that's vital for Athanasius and vital for us. You don't simply look to Jesus the Son to know that God is a Father. You look to Jesus the Son to know that God is your loving Father. You see, through the Son you get to see that the great love of the Father gets aimed at us. So 1 John 4:10, John, we saw it briefly. 1 John 4:10, in the sending of the Son, God showed his love by sending his Son for us. And so we get to see, as the Son comes to us, we see just how loving the Father is. Let me ask a quick question. Why did God send his Son to the world? Why? Yeah, so John 3:16, God so loved the world that he sent his Son. Any other reasons? John 17, because that's true, but amazingly there's even more primal and potent reason underneath that as to why. John 17, an extraordinary chapter in John 17. I think we'll just dive in at verse 26 because of time. The Son is speaking to the Father. And the Son says to his Father, righteous Father, verse 26, I have made you known to believers and will continue to make you known. Why? In order that the love you have for me may be in them. Wow. I'll make you known that the love you have for me may be in them. Then, John 1:18 describes the Son as being eternally in the bosom or lap of the Father, loved by him there. We would scarcely dare imagine it, but what Jesus declares is that, verse 24, I want, Father, those you have given me to be with me where I am. That is why the Father sent the Son. That we who've rejected him might be brought back, and not brought back merely as creatures, but be brought back as children to enjoy the abounding love that the Son has enjoyed for eternity. That we might be brought into that fellowship. And so the Son unites us to himself by the Spirit, and so we're in him. So that we might freely share all that is his. United to his bride, his people, he brings us before his Father, one with himself. And so, he can say, John 17, verse 23, You have loved them even as you've loved me. And so as the Son brings me before his Father with their spirit in me, I can now pray, Abba. Because their fellowship I now freely share. The Most High is my Abba. And the Son is my great brother. The Spirit no longer simply his comforter, but mine. You look to Jesus, else you'll forget what this God is like, a loving Father. You look to Jesus, else you'll forget that he's our loving Father. And by the Spirit of Sonship, we may call him our Abba. We sinners can call him Abba, our Father. That's at the heart of what Athanasius wonderfully, penetratingly refreshed the church in the knowledge of. And he's seeing that if we are a people who speak of Jesus as the revelation of God, the Son of the revelation of God, then we have a beautiful gospel, a beautiful God. As Luther put it, here in this God, we may look into God's fatherly heart and sense how boundlessly he loves us. With that God, with that salvation, that would set our hearts aglow. Let me pray for you. Oh, our Father, that we can call you that. Our Father, your humble, loving Son is the radiance of your glory, the exact representation of your being. From Zion, perfect in beauty, he shines forth. And so through him, we see the splendor of your generosity, your kindness. We see that you are so good. For he reveals you. Blessed. Blessed be your name. Our Abba. In your Son's glorious name. Amen.
We're going to close out the time by singing one song of response. We're going to think about the fact that as a result of Christ's cross, those of us who were once God's enemies can now be seated at his table. And so we say, Jesus, thank you. So let's stand and sing, "The Mystery of the Cross I Cannot Comprehend."